She's too young, Basia said, knowing as the words came out that it was the wrong tack. Frustration knotted his throat, and he put his dinner half-eaten on the armrest. She won't be by the time she gets there, Lucia said. If she went with the first shipment and transferred at Medina, she could be on Ganymede or Ceres Station in 19 months. 20. We need her here, Basia said, his tone hard and definitive. The conversation was over, except that it wasn't. I don't regret coming here, Lucia said, and you didn't force me to come. The months after Ganymede, when we were all living like rats packed too tight, all the ports that wouldn't take us in, I remember that. When Mao Kwiatkowski was dissolved, I was the one who helped Captain Andrada draw up the salvage papers. I made the Baba Piccola our ship. I know. When we took the vote, my voice was with yours. Maybe living so long as refugees made us wild or brave, I don't know, but to come here, to begin everything again under a sky, under some new star, I thought it was as obvious as you did. And I don't regret coming. Her tone was fierce now. Her dark eyes glittered and flashed, daring him to disagree. He didn't. If we spend the rest of our lives mining lithium and trying to grow carrots, I will be delighted with that, she went on. If I never reattach another ligament or regrow a lost thumb, then fine, because I chose it. Jacek and Felsia didn't make that choice. I'm not sending my children back, Basia said. What would they get back there? With all the work that needs to be done here? With all the things there are to be learned and discovered here? How is going backward a good idea? His voice was getting louder than he'd meant, but he wasn't shouting. Not really. Being here is our choice, Lucia said. Felsia's choice is where her choice is. We can stand in the way, or we can help. Helping her back into that isn't helping, Basia said. She belongs here. We all belong here. Where we came from here. Nothing that happened before matters. We are from here now, Illis. I will go down dying before I let them bring their wars and their weapons and their corporations and their science projects here, and I will be damned if they get any more of my children. Dad? Jacek stood in the doorway. He had a soccer ball on his hip and an expression of concern in his eyes. Son, Basia said. The moaning of the wind was the only sound. Basia stood up, took his canister and then Lucia's. Taking her leavings to the recycler was a small olive branch, but it was all he had. The sense of impotent rage and shame boiled up in his throat and found no release there. Katoa, the landing pad, the concern in Jacek's eyes. The years they had spent fleeing only to land in a brick palace that his daughter wanted to leave. All of it mixed into a single, emasculating anger as hot as solder. Is everything okay? Jacek asked. Your mother and I were just talking. We aren't from here, Lucia said, as if Jacek hadn't come in, as if the adult conversation would go on with the boy there. We're making it that way, but it isn't true yet. It will be, Basia said. Chapter 6. Elvi. Elvi sat in the high meadow, her legs stretched out before her, and watched quietly. The plant analogues, she couldn't really call them plants, lifted up above the dry beige soil, straining toward the sunlight. The tallest stood hardly more than half a meter with a flat, corrugated top that shifted to follow the sun and glittered the iridescent green of a beetle's carapace. A gentle breeze shifted the stalks and cooled Elvie's cheek. She didn't move. 4 meters away, a mimic lizard cooed. This time, the answering coo was closer. Elvie fought not to bounce with excitement. She wanted to wave her hands in glee, wanted to giggle. She stayed still as a stone. The prey species waddled closer. About the size of a sparrow, it had a soft rill of something like feathers or thick hair that ran down its sides. It had 6 long, ungainly legs, each ending in a doubled hook. She wanted to see them as fingers or toes, but she hadn't seen any of the little things use the hooks to manipulate anything. It cooed again, a soft, guttural chuffing halfway between a dove's call and a tambourine. The mimic lizard waited a moment, its wide-set eyes shifting toward the little animal. Elvie watched for the tremor in the lizard's side, an almost invisible fluttering of its scale-like skin. With the speed of a gun, the lizard's mouth unhinged and a mass of wet pink flesh shot out. The prey animal didn't so much as squeak as the lizard's inverted stomach drove it to the ground. Elvie's fists wriggled in delight as the mimic lizard began hauling its internal organs back across the dry ground. The prey species was dead or paralyzed, adhering to the pink flesh. Dirt and small stones stuck to the stomach, too. Eventually, the whole mass reached the mimic lizard's 2 wide jaw, and it began the long process of drawing the messy complex back through its mouth. From her previous observations, Elvie knew it would take the better part of an hour before the mimic lizard's newly concave sides filled out again. She stood up, dusting herself off and hobbled over. Her foot was still in the cast she'd gotten on that terrible first night. The pain from the broken bone was only a dull ache now, more an annoyance than a problem, but the cast made mobility an issue. She opened her satchel, the black lattice fabric ticking under her fingers, then gently lifted the feeding lizard into it. Its gaze flickered across her, untrusting. That was fair. "Sorry, little one," she said. "It's in the name of science." She closed the satchel and triggered the collection sequence. The lizard died instantly, and the internal assay sequence began, cataloging the gross structures of the animal's body, firing hair-thin needles through the corpse to gather samples at every boundary between tissues, and feeding the data up to the dedicated system in the satchel's strap. By the time she got back to her little hut and took the corpses out for storage and cataloging, the mimic lizard and its prey would be modeled in her computer. Terabytes of information ready to stream up to the Edward Israel, and from there, back to the labs on Luna. It would take the signal a few hours to travel the distance that had taken her 18 months, but for those hours, she and her work group would be the only people in all the billions of humans scattered throughout the planets who would know this little being's secrets. If God had come and offered her the Library of Alexandria in exchange, she wouldn't have taken the trade. As she tramped down the gentle slope toward her hut, the mining village spread out before her. It was tiny, 2 parallel streets with a gap in the middle that passed for a town square. The buildings were cobbled together from the supplies they'd brought and what they could find on the planetary surface. Everything stood at slightly wrong angles, like a handful of dice had been scattered there. She was used to the strict rectilinear architecture that came from living where space was precious. That didn't apply here, and it made the little town seem more organic, like it had simply grown there. Faiz was sitting on the small porch outside her hut. His skin had darkened in the week since the crash. The preliminary hydrological study had kept him and several of the others from the team out in the field for almost 2 weeks. "You know what I love about this planet?" Faiz said instead of hello. "Nothing?" He scowled at her, feigning hurt feelings. I love the period of rotation. 30 hours. You can get a full day's work, stay up getting drunk at the saloon, and still get a full night's sleep. I don't know why we didn't think of this back home. There are advantages, Elvie said, unlocking her door and stepping into the hut. Of course it means we've been here almost 6 weeks in the past month, Faez said. But thank God we didn't get one of those little spinning tops with sundown every 6 hours. Now if they can just fix the gravity. The unit was a single 4x6 meter room with bed, shower, toilet, kitchen, and workstation all hunched together. As she put the satchel into the archiving unit, it struck her how much her work was about inferring things from design. As soon as she'd seen the mimic lizard's forward-facing eyes, she'd assumed it was a predator. Anyone looking at her hut would know it had been made with the assumption that space would be at a premium. Everything was an artifact of its function. That was what made evolution so gorgeous. She looked in the mirror over her little sink. Her skin was covered in a thin layer of beige dust, like stage makeup. I don't want to do this, she said, wiping her cheeks with a damp tissue. Look on the bright side, Faez said. They've only tried to kill us once so far. You aren't helping. I'm not trying, he said, then winced at the unintentional reference to the dead man. They had cremated Governor Trying and the other casualties of the crash. Apart from one villager who'd arrived with non-responsive bone cancer, they had been the first human deaths on the world. Certainly they were the first murders. But after that, the people from the village had been nothing but kind. Lucia Merton, the doctor who'd come to help them after the crash, had followed up with each of the survivors. A belter from Ceres named Jordan had brought Elvie food that his wife had cooked for the injured. The holy man had invited her to the services at the village temple. Everything about the inhabitants of New Terra said that they were kind, gentle, authentic people. Except that someone had killed the governor, and almost a dozen others. The RCE encampment stood south of the village proper. With Elvie and Faez included, a little less than half the RCE employees on the surface had chosen to attend the village's community meeting. The others were involved in their work or still too badly injured. If she hadn't felt it was part of her job to educate everyone about the contamination hazards, Elvie would probably have stayed back at her hut too. Most of the RCE personnel were field scientists. They dressed for comfort, herself included. The only ones in formal clothes were the security team. Hobart Reeve, Murtry's second, led three armed guards in RCE uniforms that made them look like soldiers or police. They hadn't been on the big shuttle, but had arrived on a light shuttle almost immediately. When the order had come in from RCE that no new personnel were going planetside until the UN Observer arrived, Reeve had already been investigating what he always called the incident. The community hall was one side of the village's central square, set across the bare dirt and stone from the temple. Apart from the collection of religious iconography at the temple's eaves, the two were hard to tell apart. The chairs were made from industrial cowling and modified crash couches. If the village had been in a more temperate part of the planet, there would have been more local flora, some sort of wood analog to use. But this was where the lithium was nearest the surface, and lithium was what would bring money to the community. So, like a microorganism moving along a concentration gradient, all of humanity had come to these 20 square kilometers. Elvie sat at the back with the other RCE employees, except Reeve and the security detail, who sat closer to the front with the locals. She watched them all segregate without a word. No one enforced the separation, but it was there. Michaela, an atmospheric physicist, sat beside her with a smile. Annika and Tor, both geoengineers, sat on her other side, hand in hand. Faez, in the couch beyond her, talking with Sudyam, who had come down with the first small shuttle after the accident. The incident. The attack. Annika leaned in and murmured something to Tor. He blushed and nodded a little too vigorously. Elvi tried to ignore the sexual byplay. The mayor of First Landing was a thick-featured Martian woman with a broad accent and finger-cut hair named Carol Chiwiwi. Only they called her the coordinator, not the mayor. She called the meeting to order, and Elvi felt her heart starting to beat faster. The Belters had set the agenda, and so it started off with issues that were more important to them than to Elvi or RCE. The maintenance schedule for the water purification systems, whether to accept a credit line from an OPA-backed bank at unfavorable terms, or wait until the first load of lithium came back and try for better. Everything was talked about in calm, considered terms. If there was anger, or fear, or murder, they had buried it so deeply that the mound didn't show. Reeve's turn came, and he stepped smartly to the front of the room. His lips made a thin, forced smile. "Thank you, Madam Coordinator, for inviting us to speak," he said. "We have confirmation that the Independent Observer is on the way with a commission from the UN, the Martian Congress, and the OPA to assist with moving the development of the colony forward. It is our hope to have the security issues addressed before they arrive." "We hope to hang the bad guys on a rope before anyone gets here and says we can't," Fayez translated quietly enough for the words to reach Elvi's ears and no farther. "We have definitively identified the explosive used in the attack, and we are looking into which individuals had access to it. We don't have a goddamn clue who did it, and since you Hicks store mining explosives in an unlocked shed, we aren't going to figure it out anytime soon. I don't have to explain the gravity of this situation, but Royal Charter Energy is committed to the success of this colony for both our employees and this community. We're all in this together, and my door is always open to anyone with questions or concerns. And I hope that we can rely on the same kindness and collaboration that you've extended to us since we came. So, since we've got nothing, we'd really appreciate it if those of you who know who set the charges would just tell us. And also, please consider not murdering us in our sleep. Thanks for that." Sudyam coughed to hide her laughter, and Fayez flashed a grin. At the front of the room, Reeve nodded and stepped down. The coordinator stood up, looking toward the back of the room. Elvi felt a sudden, powerful need to urinate. "Dr. Okoye," the coordinator said. "You wanted to speak?" Elvi nodded and rose to her feet. It was about 10 meters to the front of the room, and Elvi walked forward with her nerves screaming. The heat of the crowd's body seemed suddenly oppressive, the smell of sweat and dust overwhelming. Her tongue felt sticky and thick in her mouth, but she smiled. At an estimate, 200 people sat before her, their eyes on her. Her heart ticked over so fast she had to wonder whether there was enough air in the room. She remembered someone telling her once to look for a friendly face in the crowd and pretend she was only speaking to them. 4 rows in on the left, Lucia Merton was sitting with her hands folded in her lap. Elvi smiled, and the woman smiled back. "I just wanted to take a minute," Elvi said, "to talk about how we can limit cross-contamination with the environment, because we lost the dome, the hard perimeter dome." Lucia looked grave. Elvi chanced to look at the rest of the crowd and then wished she hadn't. Part of the RCE's agreement with the UN was that we do a complete environmental study. We're in just the second biosphere that we've ever seen, and there's so much we don't know about it that the more we can keep it pristine, the better we'll be able to understand it. Ideally, we'd have a totally enclosed system here on the surface, tight as a ship, airlocks and decontamination rooms and... She was babbling. She grinned, hoping that someone would smile back. No one did. She swallowed. Every time we breathe, we're taking in totally unknown microorganisms. And even though we've got different proteomes, we're still big blobs of water and minerals. Sooner or later, one of the indigenous species is going to find a way to exploit that. And it goes the other way, too. Every time we defecate, we're introducing billions of bacteria into the environment.
So, now you're going to tell us how we can shit? A man's voice said.
Elvie felt the sudden heat of a blush in her neck and cheeks. Even Lucia's expression had gone cold and distant, the woman's gaze fixed on nothing. I only meant that if we were doing this right, we'd have a protected, sterile environment, and we wouldn't be going out into the ruins or cultivating crop plants in the open air because...
Because you think we did it wrong,
the man sitting at Lucia's side said. He was a big man, with a dusting of gray at his temples and in the stubble of beard, and a permanently angry face.
Only you don't get to decide that.
I understand that we're working with a complex situation here, Elvie said, her voice getting rough with desperation. But we're all living in this massive petri dish already, and I have a list of a few little sacrifices that we can all make that, from a scientific perspective...
The man beside Lucia Merton flushed, and he leaned forward, his fists on his thighs, his eyes fixed on her like a predator's.
I'm done sacrificing things to science, he said, and the buzz in his voice was a promise of violence.
Lucia put a restraining hand on the man's wrist, but others around the room had taken up the man's disdain. The sounds of their bodies shifting in the seats, the murmur of voices and small conversations of their own filled the air. Whoever killed Trying is probably in this room, she thought. And then, immediately after that, what the hell am I doing here? Carol Chiwiwi stood up, her expression pained, embarrassed on Elvie's behalf.
Maybe we better come back to that another time, Dr. Okoye, she said. It's late, and people are tired, nay?
Yes, Elvie muttered. Yes, of course. Her skin burning with shame, she walked back toward her seat and then past it, out into the street and alone in the deepening night toward her hut. Her shoes scraped in the gravel and dirt. The air was cool and smelled like coming rain. She wasn't more than halfway there, moving slowly in the near-black starlight, when a voice stopped her. I'm sorry about my dad. Elvie turned. The girl was little more than a deeper darkness in the night, a slightly more solid shadow. Elvie found herself thankful that the voice wasn't a man's. It's okay, she said. I don't think I did that very well.
No, it's him, the girl said, stepping closer. You couldn't have done right with him.
My brother died, and now Dad's not that kind of man anymore.
Oh, Elvie said, and then, I'm sorry.
The girl nodded, shuffled with something, and a pale green light no brighter than a candle bloomed in her palm, casting shadows up over the girl's face. She was pretty, the way youth is always pretty. But when she got older, Elvie thought she might be beautiful the way her mother was.
You're Dr. Merton's daughter, Elvie said.
Felcia, the girl said.
Good to meet you, Felcia, Elvie said.
I can walk you home, if you don't have a light.
I don't, Elvie said. I should have brought one.
Everyone forgets sometimes, the girl said, setting off. Elvie trotted a little to catch up with her. For a dozen meters, they walked in silence. Elvie sensed that the girl was building up to something, a confession or a threat, something dangerous. Elvie hoped that she was just being paranoid and was certain that she wasn't. When the girl spoke at last, her voice was tight with anxiety and longing, and her words were the last thing Elvie would have guessed.
What's it like going to a real university?
Chapter 7. Holden. There should be a fanfare, Holden thought. Passing through a ring into another star system, halfway across the galaxy from Earth, should be a dramatic moment. Trumpets or loud alarms, tense faces locked on view screens. Instead, there was nothing. No physical sign that the Rosinante had been yanked 50,000 light-years across space, just the eerie black of the hub replaced by the unfamiliar starfield of the new solar system. Somehow, the fact that it was so mundane made it stranger. A wormhole gate should be a massive swirling vortex of light and energy, not just a big ring of something sort of like metal, with different stars on the other side. He resisted the urge to hit the general quarters alarm just to add tension to the moment. The new sun was a faint dot of yellow-white light, not all that different from Sol when viewed from the ring sitting just outside Uranus's orbit. It had five rocky inner planets, one massive gas giant, and a number of dwarf planets in orbits even farther out than the ring. The fourth inner planet, sitting smack dab in the middle of the Goldilocks zone, was Illus, New Terra, Bering Survey 4, RC Charter 24771912-F23, whatever you wanted to call it. All those names were too simple for what it really was. Mankind's first home around an alien star. Humans kept finding ways to turn the astonishing events of the last few years mundane. A few decades from now, when all the planets had been explored and colonized, the hub and its rings would just be a freeway system. No one would think twice about them. "Wow," Naomi said, staring at Illus's star on the display with wide-eyed awe. Holden felt a rush of affection for her. "I was just thinking that," he said. "Glad I'm not the only one." He opened a channel up to the cockpit.
"Yo," Alex said.
"How fast can you get us there?"
"Pretty damn fast if you're willing to be uncomfortable."
"Put us on a fast burn schedule and get some dirt under my feet," Holden said with a grin.
"High burn'll get us on the ground in about 73 days.
73 days, Holden said.
"Well, 72.8.
"Space," Holden said, trading his grin for a sigh, "is too damn big." 5 hours into their burn, the messages started to come in. Holden had Alex bring them down to 1/3 G for dinner and played the first recording on the galley screen while he helped Amos make pasta. An older man, brown-skinned and gray-haired, stared out of the big screen at him. He had the thin features and large cranium of a belter, and just a hint of a series accent.
"Captain Holden," he said once the recording started, "Fred Johnson notified us you were coming, and I wanted to thank you for your help. My name is Kasim Andrada, and I'm captain of the independent freighter Baba Piccola. Let me fill you in on the situation as it stands."
"This should be good," Amos grunted, dumping steaming spaghetti noodles into a colander to drain them.
Holden handed him the pot of red sauce he'd been stirring, then leaned against the counter to watch the rest of the broadcast.
"The colony finally got a working mining operation running about 4 months ago. In that time, we've brought up several hundred tons of raw ore from our mine. At the purity levels we're seeing, that should translate to almost a dozen tons of lithium after refining. It's enough to buy equipment, medicine, soil, and seeds. Everything this colony needs to get a real toehold."
Naomi came into the galley, tapping away furiously at her hand terminal.
"Smells good.
She stopped when she saw the video playing and sat down to watch.
"The Edward Israel," Captain Andrada continued, "has stated that they will not allow us to leave orbit until the arbitration is complete. Royal Charter's position being that they own this lithium until someone says they don't. One of your first priorities will be to get the Israel to lift the blockade and let us take this ore to the palace refineries, where we already have buyers lined up and waiting.
Oh, Amos said, dumping the pasta and sauce into a large bowl and putting it on the table. Is that our priority?
Holden passed the playback.
Did come across as an order, didn't it?
He's OPA, Naomi said. He thinks you're here as Fred's mouthpiece.
This guy's going to give me indigestion, Holden said, killing the recording.
I'll watch the rest of this crap after we eat.
5 more broadcasts were queued up for viewing by the next day. The captain of the Edward Israel, an older Earthman named Marwick with flaming red hair and a British accent, demanded that Holden enforce the RCE charter by disabling the engines of the Barbapicola if it tried to leave the system. Fred sent along encouragement and a reminder that Avasarala was shotgunning threats about the consequences for screwing the mission up. 3 different news organizations asked for interviews, including a personal request from Monica Stewart for a live interview when he returned. Miller watched them over his shoulder until Naomi came into their room and the detective disappeared in a blue shower of sparks.
I think Monica likes you, Naomi said with a grin, then flopped down onto the double-sized crash couch they used as a bed.
Alex is taking us back up to High Burn in 12 minutes, and I want to die.
Monica would flirt with a lizard if she thought it would get her a good interview.
Tell Alex to give us another half hour so I can send a few responses. And hold on, I'll get my gun.
Naomi pushed herself up with a groan.
I'll get some coffee while you find your bullets.
Don't leave, Holden said, reaching for her arm. I don't want to record these broadcasts with Miller standing behind me.
He's only in your head, she said. But she sat back down anyway.
He won't show up on the recording.
Do you think that makes it less uncomfortable?
Really?
Naomi crawled across the bed and curled up next to him, putting her head on his chest. He tugged on a lock of her hair and she let out a long, contented sigh.
I like long flights, when we aren't doing these bone-crushing mad dashes, she said. Nothing to do but read, listen to music, stay in bed all day. You being famous sucks.
It's also the reason we're sort of rich now.
We could sell the ship, go get jobs at Pure and Clean again, do the Saturn ice run.
Holden stayed silent and played with her hair. It wasn't a serious suggestion. They both knew there was no going back to the people they used to be. Him, the XO, and her, the chief engineer, on an ice hauler that no one in the universe cared about unless it was late for a delivery. Anonymous people living anonymous lives. Would anyone even need Pure and Clean anymore with 1,000 new worlds full of water and air?
You're going to be okay without me down there? Naomi said.
The Belter colonists from Ganymede had spent months on the Barbapicola, prepping for landing on Illus. Loading up on bone and muscle growth hormones, working out under a full G until their bodies would be able to handle the slightly heavier-than-Earth gravity of the planet. Naomi didn't have the time or inclination to radically alter her physiology for this one job. Holden had argued that she would have then been able to come to Earth with him after. She replied that she was never going to Earth, no matter what. They'd left it at that, but it was still a sore spot for him.
No, I won't, he said, deciding not to revisit the argument. But there it is.
Amos will look after you.
Great, Holden said. I'll land in the middle of the tensest situation in 2 solar systems, and instead of the smartest person I know, I'll bring the guy most likely to get in a bar fight.
You might need that, she said, her fingers tracing some of the scars he'd picked up over the last couple years.
She stopped at a dark spot on his stomach.
You still taking your cancer meds?
Every day.
For the rest of my life, he didn't add.
Have their doctor look at this after you land.
Okay.
They're using you, she said,
as if they'd been talking about it all along. I know. They know this is all going to go wrong. There's no solution that doesn't leave someone angry and out in the cold. That's why they're sending you. You're an easy scapegoat. They hired you because you won't hide anything. But that's the same thing that makes you easy to blame for the inevitable failure of these talks. If I thought it was inevitable, I wouldn't have taken the job, Holden said. And I know why they hired me for this. It's not because I'm the most qualified. But I'm not quite the idiot they think I am. I think I've learned a few new tricks. Naomi reached up and pulled a hair out of his temple. Before he could say ouch, she held it up in front of him. It was the gray of damp ashes. Old dog, she said.
The flight to Illis was grueling in more ways than just the long periods at high G. Every time the Rocinante dropped to a tolerable rate of acceleration for meals and maintenance, Holden would have dozens of messages waiting to be viewed and responded to. The captain of the Edward Israel became increasingly forceful in his demands for Holden to issue threats to the captain of the Barbapicola. The colonists and their Belter compatriots in orbit were increasingly demanding that the Barbapicola be released from lockdown. Both sides accused the other of escalating the conflict, though in Holden's opinion, the fact that only the colonists had so far shed blood lessened their claim in that regard. Their argument that only the sale of their lithium ore could make them a viable colony, and that the blockade of the shipment was effectively starving them out, was, however, a compelling one. RCE continued to insist that since they had the UN charter, the mining rights and the load of lithium in orbit were theirs. 1,000 new worlds to explore, and we're still fighting over resources, Holden said to no one after a particularly long and angry message from the RCE legal counsel on the Israel. Alex, who was lounging in the op station nearby, answered anyway. Well, I guess lithium is like real estate. Nobody's making any more of it. You did hear the part about 1,000 new worlds, right? Maybe some of them have more lithium, but maybe they don't. And this one definitely does. People used to think gold was worth fighting over, and that shit gets made by every supernova, which means pretty much every planet around a G2 star will have some. Stars burn through lithium as fast as they make it. All the available ore got made at the Big Bang, and we're not doing another one of those. Now that's scarcity, friend. Holden sighed and aimed an air vent at his face. The cool breeze from the recyclers made his scalp tingle. The ship wasn't hot. The sweat had to be coming from stress. We're astonishingly short-sighted. Just you and me, Alex said, exaggerating his drawl to make a joke of it. A vast new frontier is open for us. We have the chance to create a new society with untold riches beyond every gate. But this world has treasure. So instead of figuring out the right way to divide up the damn galaxy, we'll fight over the first crumbs we find. Alex nodded but didn't reply. I feel like I need to be there right now, Holden continued after a moment. I'm worried by the time we land, everyone will be so locked into their positions that we won't be able to help. Huh, Alex said, then laughed. You think we're going there to help? I think I am. I'll be down in engineering if anyone needs me. 1 hour to burn, Alex replied to his back. Holden kicked the deck hatch release and it slid open with a hiss. He climbed down the ladder past the crew decks to the machine shop, where Amos was taking apart something complex looking on one of the benches. Holden nodded to him and kicked open the final hatch into the reactor room. Amos shot him a questioning look. But Holden just shook his head and the mechanic turned back to his work with a shrug. When the hatch slid closed above him, the reactor room flashed with blue light. Holden slid down the ladder to the deck, then leaned back against the wall. Hey, Miller said,
coming around the reactor that dominated the center of the room, as though he'd been standing on the other side of it waiting for Holden to arrive.
"We need to talk," Holden replied.
"That's my line."
The detective gave him a sad, basset hound smile.
"We're doing what you wanted. We've come through a ring into one of the other systems. You'll get to, I assume, ride me to the planet and take your look around."
Miller nodded but didn't speak.
How much of what I'm about to say does he already know? How predictive is the brain model they've made of me? Holden decided wondering that was the path to madness.
"I need to know two things," Holden said, "or this trip ends right now."
"Okay," Miller said with a palms-up, belter version of a shrug.
"First, how are you following me around? You first showed up on this ship after Ganymede, and you've been everywhere I go ever since. Am I infected? Is that how you stay with me? I've gone through two gates without ditching you, so either you're inside my head, or you're a galaxy-wide phenomenon. Which is it?"
"Yeah," Miller said, then took off his hat and rubbed his short hair.
"Wrong on both counts.
First answer is I live here. During the Ganymede incident, which is a stupid name for it, by the way, the protomolecule put a local node inside this ship."
"Wait, there's protomolecule stuff in the Rossi?" Holden said, fighting down the surge of panic. If Miller wanted to hurt him and had the means to do so, it would already have happened.
"Yeah," Miller said with a shrug, like it wasn't a big deal.
"You had a visitor, remember?"
"You mean I had a half-human monster," Holden said, "that almost killed Amos and me, and that we vaporized in our drive trail?"
"Yeah, that'd be him. To be fair, he wasn't exactly running a coherent program, that one. But he had enough of the old instructions left that he placed some material on the ship. Not much, and not what you'd call live culture. Just enough to keep a connection between the ring station's processing power and your ship."
"You infected the Rossi?" Holden said, fear and rage briefly warring in his gut.
"Don't know I'd use that verb, but all right, if you want. It's what lets me follow you around," Miller said, then frowned.
"What was the other thing?"
"I don't know if I'm done with this thing," Holden said.
"You're safe. We need you."
"And when you don't?"
"Then no one's safe," Miller said, his eerie blue eyes flashing.
"So stop obsessing.
Second thing?"
Holden sat down on the deck. He hadn't wanted to ask how Miller was in his head, because he was terrified the answer would be that he was infected. The fact that he wasn't, but his ship was both a relief and a new source of fear.
"What will we find down on Illus? What are you looking for?"
"Same thing as always.
Who done it?" Miller said.
"After all, something killed off the civilization that built all this.
And how will we know when we found it?"
"Oh," Miller said, his grin vanishing.
He leaned toward Holden, the smell of acetate and copper filling the air, or else only his senses.
"We'll know."
Chapter 8. Elvi. The sandstorms tended to start in the late afternoon and last until a little after sundown. They began as a softening of the western horizon. Then the little plant analogs in the plain behind her hut would fold their photosynthetic surfaces into tight puckers, like tiny green mouths that had tasted lemon. And 20 minutes later, the town and the ruins and the sky would all disappear in a wave of dry sand. Elvi sat at her desk, Felcia at the foot of the bed, and Faez with his back against the headboard. Felcia had become a regular visitor, more often than not to talk with Elvi or Faez or Sudyam. Elvi liked having her around.
It made the division between the township and the RCE team seem not less real, but less terrible. Permeable. Today, though, felt different. Felcia seemed more tightly wound than usual. Maybe it was the fact that the UN mediator's ship was getting close. Maybe it was the weather. "So our solar system only has one tree of life," Elvie said, moving her hands in the air as if to conjure it up. "It started once, and everything we've ever found shares that ancestry. But we don't know why." "Why we all share?" Felcia asked. "Why it didn't happen twice," Elvie said. "Only one kind of Schrödinger crystal, one Codan map. Why? If all the materials were there for amino acids to form and connect and interact, why wasn't there one schema that started in one tide pool and then another someplace else, and another and another? Why did life arise just one time?" "So, what's the answer?" Felcia asked. Elvie let her hands wilt a little. A particularly strong gust drove a wave of hard grit against the side of the hut. "Which answer?" "Why it only happened once." "Oh, I don't know. It's a mystery." "Same reason there's only one tool-using hominid left. The ones that still exist killed all the competition," Faez said. "That's speculation," Elvie said. "Nothing in the fossil record indicates that there was more than the one beginning of life on Earth. We don't get to just make things up because they sound good." "Elvie is very comfortable with mysteries," Faez said to Felcia with a wink. "It's why she has a hard time relating with those of us who feel anxious with our ignorance." "Well, you can't know everything," Elvie said, making it a joke to hide a tinge of discomfort. "God knows I can't, especially not on this planet," Faez said. "There's no point sending a geologist here." "I'm sure you're doing fine," Elvie said. "Me? Yes, I'm wonderful. It's the planet's fault. It's got no geology. It's all manufactured." "How do you mean?" Felcia asked. Faez spread his hands as if he were presenting her with the whole world. "Geology is about studying natural patterns. Nothing here is natural. The whole planet was machined. The lithium ore your people are mining? No natural processes exist that would make it as pure as what you're pulling out of the ground. It can't happen. So, apparently, whatever built the gates also had something around here somewhere that concentrated lithium in this one spot." "That's amazing, though," Elvie said. "If you're into industrial remediation, which I'm not, and the southern plains, you know how much they vary? They don't. The underlying plate is literally as flat as a pane of glass. Somewhere about 50 clicks south of here, there's some kind of tectonic Zamboni machine about which I am qualified to say absolutely nothing. Those tunnel complexes? Yeah, there's some kind of old planetary transport system. And yet, here I am. I need a letter of recommendation," Felcia blurted, then looked down at her hands, blushing. Elvie and Faez exchanged a glance. The wind howled and muttered. "For what?" Elvie asked gently. "I'm going to apply for university," the girl said. She spoke quickly, like the words were all under pressure, and then more slowly until at last she trailed away. "Mother thinks I'll probably get in. I've been talking with the Hadrian Institute on Luna, and Mother arranged that I can get back to Pallas when the Barbapiccola takes the ore, and then take passage on my own from there. Only the application needs a letter of recommendation, and I can't ask anyone in the town because we haven't told Daddy, and..."
"Oh," Elvie said.
"Well, I don't know. I mean, I've never seen your academic work." "Seriously?" Faez said with a snort. "Elvie, it's a letter of recommendation. You're not under oath for it. Cut the kid a break." "Well, I just thought it would be better if I could actually say something I know about.
When I went to Lower University, I wrote my own letters of recommendation. Two of them came from people I made up. No one checks,"
Elvie's jaw dropped a centimeter.
Really?
You're an amazing woman, Elvie, but I don't know how you survive in the wild. Faez turned to Felcia. If she won't, I will. You'll have it by morning, okay?
I don't know how I can repay you, Felcia said. But she already looked calmer.
Faez waved the comment away. Your undying gratitude is thanks enough. What's your field of study going to be?
For the next hour, Felcia talked about her mother's medical career and her dead brother's immune disorder and intracellular signaling regulation.
Elvie began to realize that she'd unconsciously thought of the girl as younger than she really was. She had the long, slightly gangly build and comparatively large head of a belter, and somewhere in Elvie's mind she'd mistaken it for youth. Felcia would have fit right in at the commons of Lower University. The light shifted from beige to deep brown to a burnt umber, and then darkness. The wind calmed. When Elvie opened her door, 2 centimeters of fine dust covered the walkway, and the stars glimmered in the sky. The air smelled like fresh-turned earth. Some sort of actinomycete analog, Elvie thought. Maybe one that was actually carried by the wind. Or maybe something else. Something stranger. Felcia headed back for the town, Faez for his own hut. As far as she could tell, Faez was one of maybe 2 or 3 other people on the science team who was still sleeping alone. Sudyam and Tollerson were the latest pairing. LaBerge and Maravalis had just broken off the relationship they'd started on the journey out, and each of them was already involved with someone else. Sex wasn't a strange thing among the scientific teams. That it was unprofessional behavior was set in balance against the fact that, especially on a years-long field expedition like this, the pool of potential mates was both very restricted and generally fairly high value. People were people. If she felt any jealousy at all, it wasn't for any of the particular relationships, but for intimacy itself. It would be nice to have someone to walk with in the darkness after the storm. Someone to wake up with in the morning. She wondered what the sexual politics were among the families of First Landing. If RCE had thought to send a social science team, it might have made a good paper. Ahead of her, and to the right, the alien ruins stood against the horizon, hardly more than a deeper darkness. Only a light was moving in them. It was small and faint, less than a star, and only visible at all because it was moving. Someone was in the ruins again, contaminating the site. She knew intellectually that she was letting herself be angry about it because it was better than feeling lonesome or guilty, but that didn't keep the rage from feeling real. She turned back to her hut, her lips pressed together. She scooped up a flashlight, checked the battery charge, and stalked out toward the ruins, the thin blue circle of light bobbing ahead of her and illuminating her way. The fine dust shifted under her feet like snow, and her thighs ached from the speed of her hike. As she neared the ruins, she thought she saw a dim light heading the other way, back toward the town. But when she called after it, no one answered. She stood in the darkness for almost a minute, feeling first unsure of herself, then embarrassed, then angry at feeling embarrassed. A path led into the ruins that even the recent dustfall couldn't conceal. Tracks as wide as a wagon where wheels had gone over the land often enough to leave ruts. Elvie shook her head and followed the path up, twisting around a high shoulder of land and into the huge alien structures. Inside, the beam of her flashlight caught the walls and surfaces, sending off glittering reflections that seemed to shift whether she did or not. Where there was shelter from the wind, there were footprints. Lots of them. It wasn't just someone from town exploring on their own. They were treating the ruins like some sort of clubhouse. Any samples the science team took from the soil here would already be compromised. The microorganisms,
a mixture of known and unknown, and whatever emerged when the two encountered each other in a totally uncontrolled environment. That the same was true for the whole township seemed insignificant. These were alien structures. They'd been built by a vast, vanished civilization about which humanity still knew almost nothing. It wasn't some kind of treehouse. "Hello?" she shouted. "Is anyone in here?" Nothing answered her, not even the wind. Shaking her head, she stalked deeper into the shadows. If anyone was here, she'd give them the talk she'd meant to give before. She would make them understand the issues, even if it took hectoring them all night. The walls around her rose at strange and unsettling angles from the ground, organic and also not, like a machine that was built to pass for the product of nature. Arches rose, looking out over the bare, dark land. The deeper Elvie went, the more there seemed to be, until she had the illusion that the ruins were larger inside than out. She was about to give up and turn back home when she saw something square. Simply being rectilinear made it stand out. The boxes were plastic and ceramic, functional gray where they weren't the bright red and yellow of warning labels. Danger, high explosive. Do not store near heat or class 3 radiation sources. "Oh, no," Elvie said to herself. "Oh, hell no."
"Dr. Okoye," Reeves said, "I'm hearing you tell me that you found explosives hidden outside of the town."
"Yes," Elvie said. "Of course that's what you're hearing me say."
"And that there is evidence of several people having been to this clandestine site." They were sitting in Reeves' office now. The light from his lamp shone warm and soft, and his rough pants and untucked shirt suggested she'd rousted him out of bed. It felt like the middle of the night, though the extended rotational period meant the darkness would be stretching on for almost another 10 hours.
"Yes," she said.
"All right," Reeves said. "It's all right. This is a good thing. I need you to tell me how to find this place."
"Yes, of course, I'll take you."
"No, I need you to stay right here. Not back to your hut, not out to the ruins. I need you right here where it's safe. You understand?"
"There was someone out there. I saw the light, and that's why I went. What if they'd still been there?"
"We don't have to worry about that, because it didn't happen," Reeves said in a carefully reassuring tone of voice that meant you'd be dead. Elvie dropped her head into her hands. "Can you give me directions?" She did her best, her voice trembling. Reeve constructed a map on his hand terminal, and she was fairly sure it was accurate. Her mind seemed to be shifting on her a little, though. "All right," Reeve said. "I'm going to have you stay here for a little while."
"But my work is all back at the hut."
The security man put a reassuring hand on her shoulder, but his gaze was already focused inward, planning some next step that didn't include her. "We're going to see you're safe first," he said. "Everything else will come after that." For the next hour, she sat in the little room, or paced. The voices of Reeve and his security team filtered in through the wall, the tones serious and businesslike. And then there were fewer of them. A young woman came to get her. Elvie had seen her before, but didn't know her name. It seemed wrong that they could have spent almost 2 years traveling out here together, and Elvie still didn't know her. It should mean something about populations, and how they mixed, and how they didn't. "Do you need anything, Dr. Okoye?"
"I don't know where to sleep," Elvie said,
and her words seemed thin, fragile. "I've got a bunk ready," the girl said. "Please, come with me." The rooms were empty, the others gone out into the alien darkness to face a terribly human threat. The girl leading her to the bunk had a sidearm strapped to her belt. Elvie glanced out the front window as they passed. The street was the same one she'd walked down the day before, and it was also wholly changed. A sense of threat hung over everything, like the promise of a storm coming, like the haze on the horizon.